Voters across the state of Illinois have chosen their local leaders. Chicago's new mayor will be Lori Lightfoot. We'll recap yesterday's results and take a look at voter turnout. Plus, 8 years ago, severe flooding hit the South and the Midwest. As our region faces even more of it today, we'll look at how political pressure affected emergency responses back then. And Lawrence Schiller took some of the most iconic photos of President John F. Kennedy's life. He's curated an exhibit featuring JFK that you can now see at the Lincoln Museum.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, record flooding has overwhelmed much of the Midwest over the past month. We'll take a look back at the 2011 floods in Illinois and Missouri and what happened when federal authorities had to make a choice between saving farmland or saving the town of Cairo. Plus, the Lincoln Museum in Springfield is home to an exhibit featuring the life of President John F. Kennedy. It's called American Visionary. But first...
Today, you did more than make history. You created a movement for change. You know, when we started this journey 11 months ago, nobody gave us much of a chance. We were up against powerful interest, a powerful machine, and a powerful mayor. But I remembered something Martin Luther King said when I was very young. Faith, he said, is taking the first step when you can't see the staircase.
That's Chicago's next mayor, Lori Lightfoot, giving her victory speech last night, thanks to ABC7 Chicago for that audio. Lightfoot won a resounding victory in Chicago's mayoral election, defeating Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle with 74% of the vote. Whether the win went to Lightfoot or Preckwinkle, it would be an historic one, as either candidate would be the first black woman elected to the office. Lightfoot will also become Chicago's first openly gay mayor. Jen Sabella is the co-founder of Block Club Chicago, and she joins us now. Jen, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's certainly been a long campaign, Jen. Lightfoot and Preckwinkle initially won 17.5 and 16% respectively of the first round of voting among 14 candidates back in February. Then last night, Lightfoot won a landslide with about 74% of the vote. Was this a surprise?
Based on polling coming out the days before the election, it wasn't too much of a surprise. We were seeing, even just driving around the city, honestly, if you just see signs in yards, it was just Lori signs everywhere. I think that Tony did get a little bit of a boost on the South Side and with the young activist community in the weeks leading up to the election day, but I don't think it was enough to... Lori ended up winning all 50 Chicago wards, which is pretty, it's a pretty resounding victory.
Yeah, I would say so. When you look back on this campaign, Jen, what were the big issues that Lori Lightfoot ran on?
Lori ran on reforming City Hall and kind of breaking with the machine. And I think that a lot of like outside people who follow Chicago politics has heard this machine thing thrown around a lot. And it does harken back to the days of, you know, the Daley era and all this corruption. But the corruption has continued. I mean, as we saw with multiple aldermen being tied up in a federal investigation and Alderman Ed Burke, who was reelected, being accused of shaking down a Burger King. I think everyone is just tired of being embarrassed of our elected officials who end up in prison or in court, at least. At least that is what we've been hearing from voters that our reporters talk to in the wards.
Of course, Tony Preckwinkle is going to stay on as Cook County Board President. Does this mean that she and Mayor-elect Lightfoot will actually be working together soon?
They're actually supposed to be at a press conference in a few minutes at Rainbow Push on the South Side with Jesse Jackson with a message of unity. So I know that there is a push for them to work together and to get things done. And during Mayor-elect Lightfoot's speech last night, she made that clear. She was saying, you know, we need to work together. And she thanked Tony for her service. And it seemed like a friendly hand reaching out. I don't know what that's actually going to mean once she's inaugurated and in office. And we'll see. Remains to be seen.
For sure. You talked a little bit about the Chicago machine and Mayor-elect Lightfoot portraying herself as a candidate of change. Do we yet know about some of the practical ways that she might be different from some previous mayors?
One big thing, it's a little wonky, but Lightfoot came out against aldermanic prerogative, which is really the thing that has tied all of these elected officials to this corruption. The practice where aldermen kind of have full power in their ward to make decisions on zoning and development. And a lot of the times they're taking money from developers, and the developers, you know, give them a big campaign contribution and they sign off on this big new development. And I think residents are getting fed up with it. They feel like this is just a pay-to-play thing, and Lightfoot said she wants to do away with the practice. Tony Preckwinkle did not say that she would want to do away with the practice, saying it's good to have the power in the hands of the people who oversee the ward. I don't know practically how she would kind of overturn this aldermanic prerogative and this immense power that aldermen have, but she has said that she plans to tackle it, and that would be a huge change for all of the sitting aldermen.
And to that point, Chicago, of course, did also hold elections for aldermen in the city. We don't have time to get all to all of these results, but which races stood out to you the most, and what do they say about the direction the city's heading?
I think there was a big, it was kind of funny last night, we heard there were like big Fox News headlines kind of fear-mongering a little bit about all the Democratic Socialists that got elected in Chicago. One big one was in the 40th Ward, which is Alderman Pat O'Connor, who's been in office since 1983. He's Mayor Rahm Emanuel's floor leader, and he was defeated by Andre Vasquez, who is a Democratic Socialist. That was a huge upset for an alderman who's been in office for 36 years. So, and that happened there. There's a couple elections that have not been called yet. They're too close to call, but it looks like we're going to have about five Democratic Socialists on the city council, come May. And there's already talk of there being a socialist caucus, in City Hall, which is definitely a new thing for the city.
Just put that in a little context. Five seats out of about how many?
50.
50, okay. Listeners throughout the state do know that Chicago Democrats hold a lot of power in Illinois more broadly, and we've talked before about how the Chicago machine itself might be in a little bit of trouble. What do last night's results tell you about all that?
I think that that's true. I mean, a lot of the machine, a lot of any of the like sitting aldermen who sided with the mayor, they suffered last night. There were a couple that hung on. Ariel Reboyes is one of them, who's been a longtime alderman and a key Rahm ally. He narrowly won, and he actually got a call from Ed Burke, the indicted alderman, while a reporter was interviewing him, and he said, you know, I'm sticking with you always. So the machine is still alive, but it's weak, and I think that it really hurt Tony Preckwinkle, who never, you know, who was always the outsider candidate, who was always fighting against the machine, but she was kind of painted as the machine due to her time as county board president.
Jen Sabella is the co-founder of Block Club Chicago. We'll tweet out the reporting that she and her colleagues have been doing. Jen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Last night, Illinois voters chose their local leaders in races for mayor, city council, school board, and other offices. In Champaign and Springfield, incumbent mayors Deborah Fank-Finan and Jim Langfelder both won re-election. When we step back, though, only a small percentage of Illinoisans chose their leaders on Election Day. Voter turnout has historically been lower for local elections, and last night was no different. In Chicago, turnout was about 32%, close to a historic low. In Champaign, that number was just 13%, and even in Bloomington, even lower at just 9%. Thomas Holbrook is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of Political Science. He's researched voter turnout in local elections, and he joins us now. Thomas, welcome to the 21st.
I'm glad to be here.
We've heard the old saying, of course, that all politics is local. But when we look at local elections across the country, is it fair to say that it's pretty low across the board?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the numbers you cited sound very familiar to me, very familiar. Actually, on the high side, the 32 or 3% turnout in Chicago, while that might be a historic low for Chicago, it's actually above average for what we usually see in mayoral elections. The study that I did, I looked at several hundred cities across the country, and on average, we saw turnout around 25%. So that Chicago number is actually a little bit high compared to other cities, but it's not unusual at all to see turnout rates in the teens, low 20% in local elections.
Yeah, and of course, to clarify, we're talking about local elections in non-presidential years here.
That's the issue. Yeah, and that's the issue. It's particularly low, and if you factor in things like the timing of the election, so you have non-presidential year, but even, I was going to say even worse, but maybe it's not a bad thing. You have elections held here in the spring of odd-numbered years when there's really not much else going on, usually not a lot of high-visibility state-level elections even. I mean, here in Wisconsin, we had a Supreme Court race that might have picked up turnout at the local level a little bit. But the timing of elections is a real important contributing factor to the overall low level of turnout in local contests.
And Thomas, has this always been true? Has this been an issue for local elections for a long time, or is this kind of a trend?
Well, it's been an issue for a long time, and in part it's an issue that has developed in part in reaction to elections in the early part of the 20th century, late part of the 19th century, where we saw really, really high levels of turnout, in particular in urban areas. Your last guest was talking about the Chicago political machines. Well, throughout the country, there used to be these entrenched political machines, mostly in urban areas, and they would really, really gin up turnout quite a bit. And so a lot of the things like moving to elections off-cycle were reform efforts to fight against the sort of influences that came with those political machines. So beginning in the early 1900s, you saw a reform movement for local elections to be held outside of congressional and presidential elections, and also for local elections to be nonpartisan rather than partisan elections. And I'm not sure about some of the elections in Illinois, but the difference between a partisan and a nonpartisan election, you're talking there about maybe 3 to 4 percentage point turnout difference just based on that.
Thomas, does the U.S. just have more elections than other democracies? Of course, we had November midterm elections, then Chicago. There was the first round of voting in the mayor's race in late February, then local elections last night. Do we know whether having so many elections contributes to that lower turnout?
Well, there is this idea of voter fatigue. And if you look across countries around the world, the U.S. has fairly low voter turnout. And another country that has pretty low voter turnout is Switzerland. And one of the explanations for Switzerland is voter fatigue. They vote on a lot of things, just like we do here in the U.S. So that's a possibility. But if we, and part of that is, you know, by voting on lots of things, what that means is sometimes when we're holding elections at certain levels of office, there's nothing else really interesting going on to drive people out to vote. So I don't know if it's so much the number of times we vote, but the fact that it's just kind of hard to get people that interested in the local races if there's not something like a congressional race or a gubernatorial race going on at the same time.
And looking more broadly, is it fair right now to say that the presidency is really the biggest driver for turnout at this point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Presidential elections and then followed by congressional elections, state-level elections. And then local elections are way down at the bottom. I think we're talking mostly here about municipal elections, but even if you get down to school board elections, elections on funding referenda, things like that, you'll see turnout numbers even lower.
What do people miss out on when they don't vote in their local elections?
Well, I mean, they are sort of giving up this idea of being able to control what's going on around them, especially in some smaller communities where sort of mathematically even their votes or the votes of some individual and their friends and neighbors together, you know, they really do have a greater possibility of affecting the outcome. And by opting out of the political process, people are also generally opting out of paying attention to what's going on, gathering information, learning some interesting things about their communities and about the candidates.
One last question for you here, Thomas. So when it comes to increasing voter turnout, we often hear about two things. One is just getting the word out and encouraging people to vote. The second involves making it easier to register and vote. One example of that is that we have automatic voter registration here in Illinois. Are there solutions specific to this problem of local turnout that could help move the needle here?
Well, those things are, I mean, those are issues for all elections, actually. I mean, I think the issues that are really sort of peculiar to local elections are the timing, the partisan or nonpartisan ballots, and then the choice to have mayor, council, governmental systems versus council manager systems. If there's a mayor, council system, people tend to get more interested in politics. You're more likely to have a mayoral election instead of just council elections. So among things that are really sort of peculiar to local elections, I'd say it's the timing, the ballot structure, and the governmental system.
Thomas Holbrook is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of Political Science who has researched voter turnout in local elections. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Oh, you bet. Thanks.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. In recent weeks, we've seen major flooding in large parts of the Midwest. Multiple states, including Iowa and Wisconsin, declared emergencies, and in total, three deaths have been associated with the flooding so far. Towns in northern and western Illinois were hit hard as well. When natural disasters like these happen, they test the systems put in place by local, state, and federal authorities to prevent the loss of life or property. In 2011, we also had major floods here in Illinois. Along the Mississippi River, six other states were flooded, including Missouri. And in southern Illinois, the Army Corps of Engineers had a plan to prevent flooding in the town of Cairo. Cairo, of course, gets its name from Cairo, Egypt, because the banks of the Mississippi River would overflow and make crops more fertile, just like the Nile. But that plan to save Cairo was delayed by public pressure from officials in Missouri and arguments over which lands were really worth saving, the Illinois town that was flooding or the Missouri farmland across the river. That delay cost millions of dollars in damage to southern Illinois. Lisa Song and Patrick Michaels have looked back and into this. Lisa is an environment reporter with ProPublica. Patrick Michaels is a reporter with Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. They both spoke with Nyla Boodoo last fall.
I think before we start, it's so interesting when we think about the history of Cairo. We pronounce it Cairo, but it's spelled like Cairo, Egypt. Of course, it gets its name because the banks of the Mississippi River would overflow and make the crops more fertile, just like the Nile, which is where we get Alexander County's name from. Lisa, what was Cairo like when the plans to protect the area from floods were first drawn up? This was in the early 20th century, right?
Right. So back then in the early 1900s, Cairo was a really prosperous city, had about 15,000 people. The river barge and shipping industry was really big, so it was wealthy, and that is basically one of the reasons why the Army Corps of Engineers decided they wanted to create a contingency plan to try and save the city the next time there was a big flood. And the way they decided to do that was they designated what is called a floodway, which is this big area of land across the river in Missouri, and they basically said, the next time there's a big flood, we will deliberately flood that land in Missouri to save Cairo.
And Patrick, how does this work so we're understanding our terms correctly? At least explain what a floodway is. How does that work with levees? And is the Army Corps of Engineers the kind of the organization that runs all of this?
Yeah, so for a long time in America's history, we had sort of a levees-only policy where the idea was to channel the river into a very precise, narrow corridor. And we found out in 1927 with a huge flood on the Mississippi that swamped a lot of the southern U.S., that was no good because it can make flooding much worse and puts a lot of pressure onto these levees. And so what the Army Corps of Engineers came up with after that was the system of floodways as sort of release valves for that river. And this one on the Missouri side of the river opposite Cairo is the northernmost one of those floodways.
And so that let's fast forward a bit to 2011, right? So we have this floodway and levee system set up. And that was obviously set up at a time when Cairo and the surrounding areas were very prosperous. But as we've talked about the recent history of that, the town was much smaller, much poorer. The floodway areas had actually gotten very valuable. Patrick, with that all in mind, can you describe to us what happened when the 2011 flood hit?
Yeah. So in the decades that followed this plan being created, this farmland in Missouri that had been sort of swampy timberland, the trees were all chopped down. Farmers came in and irrigated it and made it into this really valuable farmland. And they started, they began picking up political clout as well. And they, over the decades, made it harder for the Corps, even its written policies, to flood them. This was part of the deal. When a lot of them bought their land, they knew this was going to happen someday. But they sort of, bit by bit, leaned on the government to avoid this. When the flood started happening in 2011, the waters were creeping up. They, had meetings with Army Corps officials. Their congresswoman wrote letters. The Missouri Attorney General filed a lawsuit to keep the Corps from blowing up the levee that would flood them. And they sort of marshaled every bit of political clout they could to avoid getting swamped.
And so the idea, Lisa, though, was that this levee would be blown and then that would release the floodwaters into this farmland and save Cairo, right?
Right. So the way the floodway works is there's a giant levee that protects the floodway from flooding along the Mississippi River. And most of the time this levee is there, and most of the time when the river rises, the floodway is still protected. But when the river rises to a catastrophic super high stage, at a point where it's so high it would threaten to flood the city of Cairo, then the Army Corps has this contingency plan to literally blow up the levee in front of the floodway and deliberately flood that farmland. And doing that would be an emergency release valve and therefore reduce the pressure on the levees at Cairo to save the city. And what we saw in 2011 was as the waters are rising higher and higher, the people in Cairo were basically trying to shore up their levees, which were crumbling, with sandbags. And the mayor basically, went to the press and said, please do this emergency plan for us. He wanted the Army Corps to act quickly. He warned that if the city flooded, it would basically be like another Ninth Ward of New Orleans in Hurricane Katrina.
Right, which is, I think, what most people listening kind of have at least a little bit of knowledge of what a levee is supposed to do because of Katrina and New Orleans. There's some really great pictures of this, by the way, that ProPublica and Reveal have taken with their story. We will tweet that out. We'll have a link at our website as well at 21st Show. But it really explains, you can see very clearly visually where the water was rising and at what level the levee was supposed to have been blown. So there's this plan in place. Lisa, you talked to some residents who said they were sure the Army Corps would not have stalled like this if Cairo had been a wealthy city full of white people. And when you asked the Corps about this, they did not respond to that the delay happened because Cairo couldn't bring the same kind of political pressure that Missouri did. I wanted to actually play a little clip from a video that was taken by St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. It's of the Speaker of the Missouri House, Steve Tilley, talking to reporters about the flood response.
Would you rather have Missouri farmland flooded or Cairo underwater?
Cairo. I've been there. Cairo.
If the governor vetoes the importance.
Have you been to Cairo?
Yes.
Okay, you know what I'm saying then.
Again, that's from St. Louis Public Radio. Lisa, I understand the Speaker of the House later apologized for saying that, but what else do we know about the idea that the delay was in part because Cairo is a very poor place, most predominantly African-American?
So what we know, that these remarks by the then Speaker were probably the most famous remarks that came out, kind of stating publicly what some people were thinking at the time. We also know that in a lot of the news stories that happened during the flood, there was sort of this he said, she said mentality, where they were equating, you know, the devastation that would happen if the farmland was flooded with the devastation that would happen if the city of Cairo actually was flooded and people's lives were in danger. So there was this feeling that, you know, putting people's lives at risk was somehow equal to putting farmland and property at risk. And as the flooding was happening, the entire floodway was evacuated. But the city of Cairo, which had about 10 times the number of people as the residents in the floodway, they had a mandatory evacuation, but there were still hundreds of people who remained in the city because they were trying to shore up their levees and prevent their city from flooding. And the city that had been promised rescue and had been promised they would be safe by the federal government, their levees came very close to collapsing. We know this from subsequent studies that were done. We also know that the Army Corps of Engineers, the man who was ultimately in charge of deciding when to use the floodway, he received several warnings days earlier, telling him, you know, it's time to blow the levee, it's time to make final preparations. And he kept putting it off just a little bit longer every time. And by the time he blew the levee, the river was at 61.7 feet, based on Army Corps protocol, it's supposed to happen basically when the river is lower at 61 feet or so.
Patrick, is it just supposed to be at a certain point when the river reaches that height? Is it 60 feet? Is it 40 feet, Patrick?
You know, it inched up over the years. I think it's 61 was the height that was written into law when the flood happened, but it had actually been lower. Before that, and you know, farmers inside the floodway had pressured the Corps and sort of lobbied for this change to happen over the years.
But is it a certain point where it hits this, they're just supposed to blow it, or how does the decision happen?
Yeah, the initial design was actually that the river would sort of naturally cave in the levee walls when it got to a certain height. And what the Corps discovered was that wasn't really working with the design they had. And so what they came up with instead was that they would put pipes in the wall of the levee and then pump it full of explosives and then blow it up in a few spots when they needed to.
And
that's all written. It's very specific. Written
right.
In the law,
I would imagine it would be very specific to prevent things like this from happening. Right. But Lisa, what did Major General Michael Walsh, how long did that decision take for him to blow the levee, and why did they say it took so long?
There are all these numbers and procedures written into the Army Corps law that says you're supposed to blow the levee when it reaches 61 feet. But along with that, the Army Corps says there is always some wiggle room and flexibility and discretion. And it ultimately comes down to one person who makes that final decision. And in 2011, it was Major General Walsh. The thing about blowing up the levee is that you can't just flip a switch and blow it whenever you want. There are a series of decisions and preparations you have to make. It takes time to move the explosives to the levee. It takes something like 12 hours to pump the levees full of the explosives. And so a lot of the delays that the major had were about when to move the explosives to the levee and when to start loading the explosives into the levee. So the Army Corps actually published a history report that kind of tells you hour by hour what decisions were made. And it was by reading that report that we got the details of how at various times, starting about 3 to 4 days before the general actually blew up the levee, he was advised at various points, you know, now is the time to start pumping in the explosives. Now is the time to move the explosives to the levee. And during those points, he kept delaying and saying, no, it's not time yet. It's not time yet. And so finally, the levee blew on May 2nd, and he had been warned since several days earlier that it was time to make those final preparations.
And then what happened after the levee was blown?
The water went down very quickly at Cairo, and the city was saved. So the emergency valve did work the way it was supposed to once it was operated.
And Patrick, what kind of damage was there in the meantime to Cairo?
Well, to Cairo, there was damage from the waters creeping up and sort of seeping through the ground all the while before the levee was blown. And there was levee damage, I believe it's upstream of Cairo. Lisa knows more about that specifically. But the Illinois side got a lot of damage because of those days of delay.
Lisa?
Cairo itself, you know, none of the buildings flooded. Most of the damage to Cairo was in the levee itself. But there were rural communities near Cairo that had weaker levees. And some of those, at least one of those levees did breach, and there was widespread flooding across the county that Cairo is in, because all of those communities would have benefited if the Army Corps had blown up the floodway levee earlier. And so there's a state report that says, you know, millions of dollars in damage could have been avoided if the Corps had activated the floodway even as soon as 1 foot lower, when the river was 1 foot lower or 2 feet lower.
And then what happened to the farmland on the Missouri side? How much was that damaged in the end after the levee was blown and the floodway was flooded?
Yeah, there was a fair bit of damage. I mean, you know, when the levee is blown, it you know, the material in the levee kind of spreads out across the farmland there. But it actually recovered pretty quickly. There was you know, a lot of the farmers were able to harvest a crop later that year. The land was underwater for a couple weeks in a lot of places, but for the most part, the farmers, they had insurance claims. They recovered a lot of what they'd lost. You know, the ironic thing that we kind of get to at the end of our story is that there's a town called Pinhook that was right in the middle of the floodway, and it was founded in the 40s by black sharecroppers who weren't able to buy land anywhere else. So they sort of got this doomed land in the floodway. That was the place that they built their town. And from what I've heard from them, they didn't really have much of a seat at the table in all of these negotiations the farmers were having with the Corps and these meetings that we're talking about. They were sort of left in the dark. And, you know, from their perspective, this all happened very quickly. And now their town is completely destroyed.
I wonder, as we think about this, what lessons you think there is now, especially as we think about the flooding that we're seeing in different parts of the country. Lisa?
Well, you know, I think one thing to think about is that there's a difference sometimes between doing the best thing because it's scientifically correct and how to actually implement that with policy. So when you're thinking about what happened in 2011, the idea of designating floodways is something that makes sense scientifically. But the Army Corps, after it designated the floodway in Missouri, allowed people to continue living and farming there. And then once it was time to use the contingency plan, kept delaying. So I think there's often a difference between having a plan in place and then actually using it in the correct way so that it does what you want it to do.
Patrick, I just wanted to wrap up, especially as we're thinking about those communities in Missouri, those towns that did end up getting destroyed. I wonder what you think lessons we should be thinking about for the future.
Yeah, I think that the top level takeaway for me from this story and from a lot of our project, this is an ongoing project of ours, looking at these issues nationwide. You know, you're always going to have one side of the river against the other when it comes down to something like flooding, because everyone's sort of trying to do all that they can to save their homes. And if the federal government comes in, they're supposed to be the arbiter of disputes like that. And you know, they talk about science and they talk about, you know, the cost-benefit analyses and these sort of like cold, hard terms that sound like it's very scientific and supposed to take the politics out of these decisions. But what we've seen is, you know, a lot of times that kind of language can mask the real kind of values decisions that are taking place and deciding who gets flooded and who manages to weather a flood. Okay. So, you know, Cairo was damaged because of the delays. The farmland did get flooded, but they recovered, but the town in the middle of the floodway didn't. And it was all had to do with, you know, different decisions along the way that the federal government had made. And so, you know, a lot of times when we're talking about flood policy, I think it's important to sort of look beyond the scientific language and sort of the cost-benefit analysis language and really understand who's being set up to win and lose in these situations.
I want to thank Lisa Song with ProPublica, Patrick Michaels with Reveal for being with us to talk about Cairo in 2011. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. An exhibit tracing President John F. Kennedy's life from his boyhood to his presidency opened this past February at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Called American Visionary, it not only features iconic images from JFK's life, and some rarely seen before, but it puts the president of Camelot in context with our state's own great president, Abraham Lincoln. That exhibit is running until May 15th. Chris Wills is Director of Communications and Public Affairs from the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and Lawrence Schiller is the director, photographer, and writer who curated this exhibit. They both spoke with Nyla Boodoo back in February when the exhibit first opened.
Larry, I wanted to just start by asking you, as I was looking through some of these images, it really struck me that I am of a generation of Americans, and there are quite a few of us who only know this event through photographs. When this was happening, I guess it's not something you were thinking about at the time, how historic these images would end up being sort of seared into our national consciousness.
Well, you see, looking back as we do a few years, because we're talking about the 60s, and I'm going to refer to it as the wild, wild west of the 60s, because with Nixon losing to Kennedy in November of 1960, none of us realized that we were heading into some very, very difficult times. In the end result of the 60s, we would have five assassinations in America. So the first two or three years of the Kennedy administration, which is depicted in what I call the golden age of photojournalism, is almost a window into the future of that decade, because you have everything from the failure of the Bay of Pigs, which was an invasion of Cuba that was sponsored by the CIA, to other issues, everything from civil rights that was starting to come into the consciousness of America, to the Cuban Missile Crisis in Cuba, Kennedy, you know, running off to Europe to meet with Khrushchev. It was a very, very interesting window. We didn't realize we were looking through a window for a wild, wild west, but we were.
What was it like to return to that time as you were putting this exhibit together?
Well, I actually covered Nixon's campaign for the presidency, and it was an exciting period because you really had a feeling of youth emerging out, coming out of the Eisenhower era, which was a very, very serious era. Eisenhower represented the success in Europe in World War II. America was getting back on its feet in the early 50s. Industrial might was building. America was starting to plan ahead for its position in Europe. You know, we had the Marshall Plan that was succeeding very well. It was an exciting period of what is the future going to hold.
We're speaking with Larry Schiller. We're talking about the photographs that he took that are part of a new exhibition at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. This is an exhibit that's traveled all across the country. Chris Wills is with us from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Chris, I wonder how you think the viewing experience changes for people seeing images of President Kennedy. These are images all the way, as I said, there's the campaign trail, there's a boyhood, there's his presidency, as well as the assassination. What's it like to see this at the museum of another president, Abraham Lincoln?
Well, I think it has to add layers of significance to what you're seeing. The photos of Kennedy and his family and friends are touching by themselves, but when you add to that the layer of another assassination kind of in the background, when you have Lincoln's assassination hanging there as well, it makes it more, to me anyway, a look at America's problems and violence. It becomes not just the tragic story of Camelot, but a kind of a larger question of why does this happen in America, and are we learning anything as the decades go by?
You know, what was interesting to me, and I was really happy that the exhibit was going to be shown at the Abraham Lincoln Library, and it was great that it opened a couple days ago, what interested me was that, you know, Kennedy was a great orator. He really captured people with his speech, and so was Lincoln. You know, we know, of course, the great Gettysburg Address, but if you look at Lincoln's other speeches, they were really concise and to the point. He got a lot done through his form of communication, as Kennedy did. As was just pointed out, both their lives were cut short. The interesting thing is that we know what type of a president Lincoln was, emancipation and everything else. We don't know what type of a president Kennedy would have been. That's really the interesting thing, because his presidency had not really shown any great results, where Lincoln's presidency showed results right down almost every year.
And it's interesting that you say that, Larry, because I think there is sort of this whole mythology surrounding Camelot and the presidency and JFK as a president. Chris, the Library and Museum is actually hosting a special event tomorrow evening to sort out some of these connections, the fact from the fiction. I wonder what other similarities you all see in terms of, and what other myths, like what other things you think have been overblown?
Well, I think probably we've all seen these lists that circulate online about the eerie parallels between Kennedy and Lincoln. They both served in Congress and later were president. They were elected in 1860 and 1960. Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy. Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln. But not all of that is true. And even some of the true stuff is overblown and just kind of a meaningless coincidence. So this event, Fact versus Fiction, is meant to be somewhat lighthearted look at how much of that really holds up. It's kind of a Mythbusters segment, and we hope people learn something from it. I think there's a lot to think about in the connections between Kennedy and Lincoln that are much more significant than, you know, dates and numbers of letters in their name. I mean, their roles in civil rights, the assassinations, the communications skills, as Larry pointed out, those are meaningful parallels. The stuff that gets shared and on the internet is not.
Let me ask a question, if I may, because I think that's kind of interesting. You know, Kennedy is a product of great PR run skillfully, and the use of his wife, who, you know, the face of Kennedy all over the world. What was it like for Abraham Lincoln? Did people think of the public relations in those days, and how do you communicate and build an image? And what was Lincoln's wife like, and how was she used? I'm curious. I never thought of it until this second.
Well, back in Lincoln's time, it was more about party and platforms when it comes to reaching the voters. What did the Republicans stand for? What would they accomplish in office, as opposed to the personality that is more important today? So I think in Lincoln's time, his job, as he saw it, was to keep quiet during the election period, not stumble in a way that would raise questions about the Republican Party and make it look bad, and hope that the voters would support their platform in general as opposed to him in particular.
And I think it's also a really interesting, Larry, as you're, to your point, if we think about how photogenic John F. Kennedy, his wife, if we think about the First Lady, we think about how telegenic they were, how much that was part of their presence. And I imagine that was also, Chris, a little bit of a difference because Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln, that was not really part of campaigning.
Correct. I mean, for instance, there are no pictures of Lincoln with his wife. They certainly didn't present themselves as a couple the way that John Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy did. But Lincoln knew the value of photographs. He was he used photographs to project an image in a way that no president before him did. So he and Kennedy certainly had some of those skills and talents in common.
I wonder if we could talk about some of the photographs that are in this exhibit. Larry, as I mentioned at the beginning, there's some famous, iconic images that people associate with President Kennedy. Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, number one, because of the position of the presidency, and he was such a youthful president that attracted crowds, he was really a very, very attractive young man. And his father said to him at one point, if you can bring together the female vote, women in America, you'll win this election. And there are some pictures where you see hundreds and hundreds of women just lined up, and there's not a man in the crowd to meet JFK. And then you go into the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I have a couple photographs, because I was working for Life magazine at that time, of the effect of the scare. This first time the America really had the scare of the A-bomb. And I photographed kids lining up in the hallways in their schools, crouched in positions or hiding under desks or things like that. So the Cuban Missile Crisis is shown there in many, many examples. And of course, when Kennedy, stood up to Khrushchev and eventually went first to Vienna and then Paris, really the ambassador from the United States is Jacqueline Kennedy, because Kennedy makes this famous remark in France that he's very happy to accompany the true real spokesman for the U.S., Jackie Kennedy. And of course, the crowd goes crazy because she speaks fluent French. But the pictures really show the conflict, the problems. You see him at the Berlin Wall, and you see him on national television, and yet you see him at, 10 o'clock at night walking his son, who's about, 3 years old, to bed. That says it all, this picture of the president of the United States, walking his three-year-old son to bed. And, of course, the wonderful pictures of Caroline running around the White House, the West Wing, with her dolls, really enjoying the ability to be a child in that type of an environment. The pictures, step by step, take you through the hills and the valleys of the presidency. And, of course, there's a very interesting picture there where Jacqueline Kennedy was wearing this powdered pink suit. And of course, 2 years later, her husband is assassinated and blood is sprayed all over that suit as they drove through Dealey Plaza in Texas, in Dallas, Texas. So, those two photographs, almost a year and a half, 2 years apart, are really interesting because, as many people know, Jacqueline rarely, rarely wore the same dress twice.
Mm. Larry, as you have mentioned a couple of times, your background as a photojournalist, you worked for different media outlets through many administrations. I'm wondering how you think the climate has changed for photojournalists, especially covering the president today.
Well, photojournalism doesn't really exist since JFK's assassination, even though it did go on for about another 6 to 8 years. Because, you see, on the second floor of the Dallas police station, when Lee Harvey Oswald was captured, there was one television camera that weighed about 600 pounds at the end of the hallway. It was the first live broadcast in the United States and around the world of an event. And from then on, the television camera, whether it was 16 millimeter footage or eventually portable cameras, started to communicate to the world. They became, the television networks became the educator of the world. Prior to that, it was Life, Look, Saturday Evening Post, Perry Match, and of course, National Geographic. By the time you get up into 2000, Apple and the Android phones with their cameras in it are the journalists of today. Every single person with a phone is a photojournalist. So photojournalism now doesn't have maybe 60 great journalists around the world. It's got 600,000 people with phones, and any one of them can be a photojournalist and make the evening news.
I want to thank Larry Schiller for taking the time to join us, as well as Chris Wills from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. We've been learning about President Kennedy and President Lincoln on this President's Day. We'll have info on the exhibit. It's called American Visionary, John F. Kennedy's Life and Times, again, at the Abraham Lincoln Library and Presidential Museum. We'll have that up at our website at 21stshow.org. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
That's all we have time for today. Follow us on Twitter, search for 2NST Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.